Counsel, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Norman Mueller. I represent Rodney Culverwell in the appeal of this conviction. The first issue I want to address is the instructional error in which the trial court added a dual mental state to the willful destruction of elk statute. And I think to put this in proper context, we need to talk about sort of the historical development of this statute. The jury was instructed that Mr. Culverwell could be found guilty if he knowingly hunted or took an elk and intentionally abandoned the elk. This saga sort of starts before the court's this court's decision in Lawrence. I think this statute was initially intended, and I think legislative history shows, to address the trophy killing situation. And in Lawrence, the statute at that time only referred to with intent in the trophy killing part of the statute. There were two different methods that you could commit the crime. With intent, you would hunt or an elk, and with intent to remove various body parts, trophy killing. And the second part of the statute, how you could violate that statute, is when it said kill and abandon. And I think it's important to keep in to recall that it said kill at that point. This court ruled that even though there was no mental state other than the specific intent to remove body parts, that this was not a strict liability offense, knowingly applied to the two methods the crime by which this crime could be committed. Subsequently, the legislature changed the statute.
Did they change that statute before the offenses in the case, in the present case?
Yes. They did.
Effective date before the offenses in the present case?
No, but everybody agreed that this new step, I think I'm right about that, but everyone agreed, prosecution including and trial court including, that the new statute, which I'm not yet to in describing, is what applied to Mr. Culverwell's case. So what happens after the Lawrence decision is there's what I'll call the First Amendment, which is not yet the statute applicable to Mr. Culverwell's case. The Second Amendment added essentially a third method of killing, of committing this crime. It kept with the specific intent, the trophy killing statute. It added abandon a carcass or body. And the third method was now it was take instead of kill and abandon. Take is broader than kill. So now the statute is expanding. Again, if you look at the statute, it seems that what the legislature is trying to address is the trophy killing situation and what we'll call the thrill killing situation. There, someone goes out and kills or hunts a bunch of animals and also abandons the carcasses. The next case this court had was Gordon. The Gordon case, again, this court said knowingly is still the culpable mental state. And this court said if the legislature wanted to add an intentional element, a specific intent requirement to the second and third methods of committing this crime, they can do so. Well, they did so. It's exactly what the legislature did. And what I would say the history shows is sort of legislative dismay at the Department of Division of Wildlife's prosecution of Mr. Gordon. The legislature added intentionally to both the second and third methods of committing the crime. The issue then is, what is the mental state for the crime with which Mr. Culverwell was charged? The trial court, as I said, the trial court vacillated on this issue because the trial court first said, I agree, they added intentionally, there should only be one mental state, that's what I'm going to instruct the jury on. But at the end, the court came back to saying, no, I'm going to still instruct that the second element of defense is knowingly hunt or take and intentionally abandon the elk. Intent. Judge Russell.
Counsel, I'm sorry, I'm fixated on this point, so I need to ask you this question. Am I right that the effective date of the statute is after the acts that occurred here?
I believe that that's right.
So why is it even possible that we were arguing about the effect of the new statute? I mean, I understand there was an agreement that the new statute applied, but why is that so? How could that be so?
Well, I was out and researched this since it was agreed to below and not raised by the Attorney General here. I would say in general, so I'm going to pull this out of the air, Your Honor. There are provisions that provide that a defendant has the benefit of ameliorative changes in the law. And so I think that's one thing that all the parties agreed to. And because I haven't specifically researched this and actually can't put the dates in line, and I hope I'm not misspeaking as to the effective date of the statute, because it is honestly something I didn't look at in preparation for this argument. So I have to go back to the fact that everyone was on the same page at trial, that intentionally was the mental state applicable, and the question, well, the intentionally in the statute applied, the new statute applied, the current statute applied, and it really boiled down to where the legislature put intentionally in that third method of committing the crime, because the statute says took and intentionally abandoned. And the issue is, does that, as the attorney, one of the arguments the Attorney General makes, is that means that it applies only to the abandonment element. It does not apply to the taking element. Our argument, and the Attorney General did not discuss Colby, our argument is when the legislature has made it this clear, when they say we have specific intent here, we have intentionally in the second version, second method, we have intentionally in the third version, or third method of committing the crime, there is only one mental state, and you can't, the court cannot read into that knowingly as an additional added element. The other instruction, and this error went to the four felony convictions, which were the obviously the ones that carry the most impact to my client.
If I follow your argument, counsel, it is that because the prior sections or the other two ways of committing the crime, it's clear that intentionally applies to all of the elements of those crimes, that expresses the legislative intent that on the third method of committing the crime, even if there were an ambiguity, the prior use of it would indicate the interpretation is to be applied to all the elements. Is that a awkward way of saying what you're saying?
No, it's actually the point I'm about to mention was, I think it's clear, but if it isn't, if there's an ambiguity, as you pointed out, Judge Criswell, then we can rely on the Summers case, which is the rule of lenity, and that means that it is to be applied to all the elements of this offense.
Is the rule of lenity automatically invoked because there's an ambiguity, or do we look for other types of things and apply the rule of lenity at the end of this process if we can't otherwise resolve the ambiguity?
It's the latter, Your Honor. It's sort of the rule of last application. If you read Summers, since it's my case, I think I remember it. The legislative history was really garbled, more so than most times. And that's what ultimately relied on.
Counsel, aren't most cases in this jurisdiction, criminal cases, your cases?
If that's some comment on my age, Your Honor.
No, your experience.
Thank you, Your Honor. The second instructional error that occurred in this case is the failure to give the choice of evils instruction. This, it seems to me, is a case for which the choice of evils defense was really meant to be. We had all the elements available here. You had the urgency. You had the emergency, which was created. You had the urgent situation, not caused by any acts of Mr. Covello. This is the weather, this is nature, the elk were descending on his land. And then you have sort of the weighing of what I think the statute talks about, applying the standard I think it's morality, and I can't remember the statutory phrase. But the weighing that goes into whether or not what a particular defendant did fits within the choice of evils, even though what the defendant might have done violated a law. And what we've gotten into, I think, with choice of evils is these pretrial determinations, which are really removing from the jury something that is classically a jury question. The choice of evils statute, I don't think, has been amended since it was enacted back in the 70s sometime. And the trial court here, despite an extensive offer of proof, said, well, I don't think it applies. But counsel renewed that offer at the conclusion of the evidence. A tendered instruction was given to the court, and again, the court refused it. And counsel was left with several dead elk, that probably didn't fit exactly within the defense of person or the defense of property instructions that were ultimately given. Although, as I think we point out, the defense of property instructions had problems in the sense that they put in this exhaustion requirement. But nevertheless, the district attorney argued in closing as to at least one or two of the incidents, there is no affirmative defense. The affirmative defense doesn't apply to this one because this particular elk at the particular time wasn't eating. This particular elk at that particular time wasn't destroying a bale of hay. But what we had was Mr. Caldwell trying to defend his property, being confronted with this emergency situation. The nature of the crime that he committed is, number one, a low-grade felony, a crime that we have argued was originally meant to apply only to trophy killing and thrill killing situations, and it's an expansion to a situation where a landowner is exercising his fundamental constitutional right to defend his property, shifts that balance over to his decision to either do a mercy killing or the death of an elk occurred that was perhaps more accidental. Nevertheless, it was his weapon that did it. These are classic jury questions. This is precisely where the voice of the community should have been heard, and the trial court deprived Mr. Caldwell of his right to have a jury determine that. And since I have only 2 minutes, unless there are other questions, I'm going to reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Farrow, registration number 35754, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. In his briefs, the defendant, Mr. Caldwell, essentially argues that he has an unlimited, absolute constitutional right to kill any wildlife that adversely impact the chosen use of his property. He is wrong. His contentions are in places procedurally improper, and as a whole, they lack merit. From the beginning of this case, the defendant has argued that the wildlife statutes he was charged with violating are unconstitutionally overbroad as applied to him. He first used this contention to argue he was immune from prosecution entirely because his constitutional right to defend property was essentially absolute. The trial court rejected this immunity argument, and the case proceeded to trial. In the opening brief, it seemed that the defendant had resurrected this argument, and that is why the people responded that the claim was procedurally barred. In the reply brief to the defendant, Mr. Mueller states that the defendant is no longer raising pretrial immunity.
Why is the claim procedurally barred, counsel? Why isn't that another formulation of insufficient evidence to sustain a conviction?
If if it were framed in exactly those terms, that's a very different claim. But to assert that I am immune from prosecution, I have an absolute constitutional right to defend my property, you cannot, I do not even have to suffer standing trial for these offenses, that is immunity. And we see it, about the only context that we see it in the state is in the Make My Day context, which is a statutory immunity. And that's why I draw the comparison to those cases with the Rule 21 requirement. So, again, it appears that that issue is no longer before the court, and that's fine. That's one less issue for the court to address.
Oh, wait a second. Still a sufficiency of evidence issue before the court?
There is still a question of whether the offenses that he was charged are constitutional. That's the way I construe the claim. I think maybe we're probably addressing the same issue. And I'll continue. At trial, the parties, this issue continued to be reasserted. The parties agreed that the defendant was entitled to assert defensive property, but they disagreed on how the affirmative defense instruction should be drafted. The trial court was working from whole cloth in this case. A defensive property instruction in wildlife has never been recognized in the state of Colorado. And there has never been any attempt by a published decision by a court in this case to draft an affirmative defense instruction. So the court was looking to other states. And essentially there's four states that have weighed in and said that they recognize a defensive property and they have attempted to draft affirmative defense instructions. Three of those states, substantively, their instructions are the same. The fourth state, Washington, is a little bit different. Now, what happened in this case is that the prosecution advocated for the three, which he represented with a Wyoming case, and the defendant advocated for the Washington formulation of the rule. And the difference, as Mr. Mueller briefly alluded to, is this idea of whether or not the fact finder must find that the landowner defendant exhausted every available remedy before employing lethal force. Curiously, the Washington case doesn't leave the issue out completely. It doesn't require the fact finder to consider that, but it does allow the fact finder to consider it in its option. In any event, on appeal, the defendant has really abandoned this claim. There isn't any substantive argument about the differences between these two proposed instructions. There is no particularized allegation of how he may have been prejudiced on the four counts in which he was convicted. There's just really is no basis to review it. So what does that leave this court?
He didn't argue in his brief that there was a difference that ought to be, that was still unconstitutional, requiring him to exhaust his other remedies is an unconstitutional condition on his right to defend his property. He didn't argue that in his brief?
I think that's giving it a lot of credit, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't believe that there is any time a connection has expressly been made to this must exhaust available remedies requirement, which is the meaningful difference between these competing instructions, tied to any explained constitutional right that prejudice in some way prejudiced him on the four convictions. Excuse me, the four elk for which he was convicted. Without that, we just speculate. And I will just add that, you know, in light of the, there are some differences between the instructions, but again, the Washington instruction, which he sought at trial, I'm not sure if he still wants that or not, but they did seek it at trial. The Washington instruction would have allowed the jury in this case to consider whether or not Mr. Coverwell exhausted every available remedy. We could have the very same result that we ended up with, is what I'm trying to say. Now, what does that leave this court that it that is properly before it? Well, first, it can examine the alleged conflict between the wildlife statutes and the Constitution. The defendant claims that Article 2, Section 3 guarantees a fundamental right to defend property. Well, whatever that the Constitution guarantees, whether it is or not a fundamental right is irrelevant. Whereas here, the state has exercised its police power in a way that limits individual rights, the only question is whether that exercise is reasonable. And that's from the Roberts line of cases, Robertson line that's cited in the brief.
Counsel, were any of the four animals in this case killed, that for which the convictions were based, were they killed in defending his property?
There were some allegations that they were, possibly. Number 65476 was an elk that he found under a feeder.
It was a young calf, was it?
Yeah, I believe that Mr. Caldwell stated that he was concerned there was a possibility of injury to someone in his family, so that would not be property. I apologize, that would be a person. I think there's just a vague inference that this wandering elk could eat his hay or somehow damage his property. 65481 was the tractor elk, and there was an allegation of danger to person with that one as well, but the other allegation was that it was somehow impacting his full utilization of his property, that at that given time he had chosen to drive his tractor in a particular manner, and the elk was impeding his progress. I think that under his broad, almost absolute construction of a defense right to defend his property, that he considered that to be an impact on full utilization. 65482, the other one, which is possibly hit by a deflected bullet. It's unclear, I think, from the record. I think you could make the inference either way, that the shot that was fired at a different elk allegedly was fired either in self-defense and or to defend the hay.
I thought that was where the elk was entangled in the fence and couldn't be removed, and that he shot it, putting in effect out of his misery, and that the bullet would defected and hit the calf.
Okay, you may be correct, Your Honor. I apologize.
So to the extent that he was, it could be argued at least, that to the extent that he was killing the elk that was entangled in his fence, mm-hmm. that was a fence property.
I think it could be argued. I think that it was inferred, because the idea that the elk had destroyed the fence, the elk was damaging the value being entangled, the fence essentially was damaged, and it couldn't be repaired until the elk was removed. Couldn't remove the elk unless you killed the elk.
Let me ask you this question.
Yes.
Was there any controverting evidence or testimony with respect to the method of which the deaths of the elk occurred, at least to the extent that the defendant here in those cases admitted that he may have or did in fact kill the elk? Was there any controverting testimony as to the method or the circumstances?
I don't really believe so, Your Honor. I mean, there really isn't an issue that there was a knowing taking of these elk in the manner that each one of them was killed. And that's why I think that we're working so hard to have the intentional mental state applied to the taking, because it would have possibly eliminated some of the convictions. But as far as knowing taking, I don't believe that was an issue.
That wasn't my point. My question was this. Aside from the defendant's testimony as to how he came to kill the four elk that were involved here, mm-hmm. was there any controverting testimony that the circumstances were not as he testified?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, the defendant is the primary witness of these events. The wildlife office did do an investigation, but I honestly don't recall the specifics of all the evidence. There may have been some different inferences from the way the bullets trajectories and
go ahead.
Just the way that they found the bodies and where they found the carcasses. The physical evidence that they found, in some cases, contradicted what his account was.
That the prima facie case for the prosecution was simply finding the dead carcasses and the method of killing, i.e. rifle, and on defendant's property.
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. It's well established that laws tending to conserve wild game are a proper exercise of the state's police power. There's a long line of cases in this state to that effect. And while a license is generally required to take game, the General Assembly has not enacted an outright prohibition on protecting your property from wildlife. What they've done is they've regulated how you may protect your property, and they've done so in a reasonable way. They provide damages. They can provide damage prevention materials. They can issue, the Wildlife Department is authorized to issue kill permits. There are even some presumptively dangerous species that you don't have to go through an administrative process. Bears, mountain lions, dogs, they can maybe be killed on site in certain circumstances. Finally, you can seek compensation through the takings clause. So there's a variety of remedies here, but becoming a vigilante and killing wildlife on your property at will is not one of them. Secondly, the court can determine whether the defendant was entitled to defend his property against the elk in this case, and that really goes towards the affirmative defense instruction given. But again, we are arguing that the only remedies available to the defendant are to seek compensation. That is what the Colopy case held, and that's what these wildlife statutes hold. Just as a landowner could not kill a government contractor that entered his property on a bulldozer, he may not use lethal force against state-owned wildlife. These are state actors when they enter private property.
So is it your position that if the court erred, so to speak, in not giving a choice of evils defense, there was harmless error because he was never entitled to a choice of evils defense to begin with?
Well, I think there's two issues there, Your Honor, on that point.
Well, I thought you just told us that, you know, the only remedy he was ever entitled to was either money or getting a kill shot permit. I thought your position was he couldn't defend his property himself.
That is my position, yes.
So your position is that he would never have been entitled to a choice of evils instruction to begin with?
Not on a defensive property ground. Now, it doesn't matter, Your Honor, because even if he had been, the error was harmless because he was afforded a defensive property instruction at trial.
But was he afforded a choice of evils instruction?
And no, he wasn't, but he has yet to explain. He just generally alleges that somehow there was an overlap there, that somehow without choice of evils, what he would have been convicted on defensive property alone, he would not have been convicted on. But there's nothing specific. Why? Why would a rational juror on one of these four animals have rejected a defensive property defense, but yet found a choice of evils defense premised on defensive property, when the choice of evils defense requires exhaustion of all remedies?
I thought his choice of evils defense was also based on mercy killing, aside from defensive property.
I agree, and that's why I said initially there's two separate questions there. I think the mercy killing ground is a different ground. Mercy killing is not defensive property.
And is that a defense?
Is it a defense?
Yes.
Well, it could certainly be raised.
If the jury believed that elk were killed for purposes of mercy, is that a legitimate acquittal?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
So you're saying that mercy killing is not a defense?
No, it was not given in this case on that ground. I don't believe, as I've argued, that it was requested on the mercy killing ground alone. But even if it had been, such an instruction would not have been appropriate, as we argued in the brief.
Counsel, your time is waning here, and I need to ask you a question.
Please.
About this statute that apparently was amended effective after the acts, and yet it was conceded or agreed upon that it would apply here. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to me what was the basis of the agreement?
You know, I don't recall from the record, but I don't believe that it conclusively establishes why the parties decided to. I do think that Mr. Mueller, when he stated that they were, I think the parties were concerned that the defendant would be deprived an ameliorative benefit of this legislation. But I don't recall that specifically. There was not an expansive discussion on point.
Was he entitled to the ameliorative benefits of this legislation? The reason why I ask this is, if he's right that the new statute required both intents both times, mm-hmm. but the new statute was inapplicable to him, wasn't the error harmless?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
I'm going to give Mr. Mueller a chance to tell us why it wasn't.
Sure, I'm fine with that. The people made a decision not to push that argument. I felt like we probably pushed enough procedural bars in this particular case, and we're quite confident that the trial court reached the correct result even under the amended version of the statute. The Gordon case, if you take a look at the Gordon case, taking was not an issue in that case. The only issue in that case was the abandonment. The reason he was convicted is because abandonment was knowingly, not intentional. And that was why the statute was changed.
Counsel,
thank you.
Time has expired.
See if I can remember some of the questions. Judge Criswell, in answer to your question, I don't think there was any direct evidence conflicting Mr. Coverwell's testimony about how the elk died, but I will tell you, at a minimum, the district attorney argued that at least as to some of those elk, that account was not credible, and then based it on, you know, where the elk was, and did it make sense that Mr. Coverwell would have taken his pistol to shoot at a bull elk, which he ultimately killed. And then have gotten closer. He was really, the district attorney was really contesting the argument about the ricochet shot. The choice of evils is different than the defense of property, and I was surprised when I took over this case to see the attorney general arguing there is no right to defend property in Colorado by killing an elk. The district attorney conceded there was such a right. The district attorney agreed that all four charges could include without affirmative defense, and that affirmative defense was the defense of property instruction. There was no objection to the defense of property instruction, instruction number 20. That was an instruction submitted by the defense, agreed to by the district attorney, given by the trial court. It was instruction 21 that added, at the request of the district attorney, over the objection of the defense, this exhaustion requirement. And you're right, whoever asked it, there is no direct challenge to instruction 21 as a separate issue, but it is one of the major reasons, and it is discussed as to why application of these wildlife statutes under the facts of this case, as established at trial, unconstitutionally deprived Mr. Coverwell of his right to defend property. I'm out of time.
I have a question.
Yes.
Brief. It may have been the reply brief. I'm not sure. You talked about, I can't remember, it was the Washington or the Montana case, in which they talked about the relationship between the necessity defense and a defense of property. And at that point, I think your reply brief said something to the effect of, aha, although they gave a necessity brief, there was error because it was not sufficiently protective as would have been a right to defend the property brief. Remember that?
Yes, I do. And that's the Vanderhoof case.
Then my question to you is, would it have been harmless to deny the choice of evils defense since it's not as protective as a proper right to defend your property defense?
It is not harmless in this case because the district attorney made several arguments in the closing argument. They spent a lot of time talking about they didn't exhaust the remedies, and then they spent additional time saying that this particular elk was not destroying property. That can't be in defense of property. There is no defense here. That's where the choice of evils would have come in. These were overlapping, interlocking defenses, and we needed both of them.
Thank you. Okay.
I'd like to make a comment, not a question. I hope the division will allow me. I just want to say to counsel for both sides, what a pleasure it was to read briefs and to hear arguments of this quality. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case will stand submitted. Opinion will issue in due course. The court will stand in recess and the bailiff will so announce.